have nothing to disclose except that I'm a mad keen animal lover and a nurse gerontologist, so I'm an aging person. It's more important with each passing day. It's my privilege to direct the Research Center for Human-Animal Interaction at the University of Missouri. We engage in a robust program of research and programs that essentially put humans and companion animals together in what we view as unique ways for the betterment of both ends of the leash. And so I'm pleased to tell you about a community project that we conducted, which involved a number of collaborators in getting around this idea of problems associated with obesity, with sedentary lifestyle, and how we might do something to modulate that problem. So what we did was to develop a community-based physical activity program in collaboration with a couple of other entities, but I'd like to tell you a little bit here about the research, which is pretty clear that physical activity is the way for us to promote health in people. The CDC and the World Health Organization are recommending 30 minutes of moderate to vigorous activity every day, 7 days a week, for us, irrespective of age, except even more for children. And so we know that this physical activity promotes many beneficial things, most of which are listed here, in addition to more recent findings delineating the importance of this activity for staving off dementia, in particular in older adults. So we know that physical activity is important. The question is, how do we get people to do it? And that has plagued people in public health for a long time, and it will continue to do so if we don't keep looking at holistic, innovative models for doing that. So walking has been identified as a very beneficial activity by the CDC. It is deemed to enable us to meet their recommendations. It's also endorsed by the World Health Organization. So it's very important for all of us to keep walking. And it has associated many benefits, which you can see, much like physical activity in itself, that are particularly related to walking, so that we can see decrease in, for example, evidence of type 2 diabetes. That's very important given the horrible fact that now children are getting this condition. So we see that there are very many reasons to walk, and that it requires no physical specialized activity equipment. It can be relatively inexpensive. It can be done across a wide range of populations in a wide range of areas. And so it seems like it might have longevity or legs, as I would put it, as a useful physical activity. Thank you, Tom. It's always nice when someone laughs at a very sick joke. Thank you. That's good. Okay. But the question is, again, how do we get people to do it? There's pretty good research on motivation for physical activity, and we look at, in particular, the kinds of things that we can draw on in our work, and that is the attitude that doing this activity will be beneficial for one. But also in our work, we have identified this notion of altruism, and the idea of volunteering as a beneficial motivator to encourage people to engage in this useful activity. Social support has been highly regarded for a very long time as a predictor of someone's motivation for engaging in physical activity, in particular walking. And some colleagues at in Chicago at Northwestern developed a walking program that was clearly indicative that it was the social support of walking a dog that was beneficial for the people. And that there is a factor in this that's environmental, so if you live in an unsafe neighborhood, you might be less likely to walk. If you're worried about uneven pavements or terrible condition of the sidewalks or of even a good place to walk, that you're less likely to walk. So motivation is harder. But as you can see, this dog walking activity has just typically grown forelegs. And a colleague from the CDC, Jackie Epping, and I started a dog walking interest group. Well, we met each other, and I said, I'm doing this dog, walk a hound, lose the pound project. And she said, yeah, I'd like to get that started in Atlanta. And she says, you know, we could be a dog walking interest group. I said, yeah, I guess there's only two of us, but we could be an interest group. Okay. Well, so we started the dog walking interest group, and now there are well over 100 members globally. We had the group, then got together and got it a name. It's called IDWAG, International Dog Walking Activity Group, because it didn't want to just be an interest group anymore. And as a result, that was about, Jackie and I started about 10 years ago, and now you can see a lot of publications that have emanated from those in that group, and in particular, the Australians have been doing a magnificent job of demonstrating some very powerful things about the benefits of dog walking, not the least of which is that there's social capital in neighborhoods where people walk their dogs regularly. That is, that dog walkers notice things that look awry. They notice if an older adult's newspapers are piling up. They might be more willing to check on their older adult neighbors. Not that we're all nosy, but that we notice things because we're out there every day at least once or usually twice, and that in fact that translates not only to social capital of people perceiving those neighborhoods as safer and more friendlier, but it actually translates, per our Australian colleagues' work, into better property values, which is a very interesting thing if you think about the big longevity of a public health intervention conducted in a community level, that it could do that. So we've seen that dog walking has grown in popularity, but also the science around it has grown significantly. But what about people that don't have dogs? Well, what about them? How can we address people, and does this as an intervention, dog walking, even apply to them? Well, we need to look at what might motivate them, and many people are motivated to help a dog, and so this project was based on that. We started the project, it was held at Columbia, Missouri, at the Central Missouri Humane Society, which is the regional animal shelter that takes in around about 1,300 dogs a year. Unfortunately, not all are adopted. They're not a no-kill shelter. They're an open-door shelter, so they get a lot of the animals that some of the no-kill shelters won't take. And what we wanted to do was to design something for benefiting both the people and the dogs. So we got together with the Parks and Recreation Department to help promote the activity. In fact, they included it in their whole battery of programs and filtered it right into their PR machine, which was very beneficial for us in getting people to know about it and to register and to come. We worked with the Department of Health and Senior Services, who provided additional information pamphlets and helped us in encouraging older adults to come to this project. And it occurred on Saturday mornings at the animal shelter from the months of April through October. Icy winters in Missouri prevent people from wanting to do this. I'm sorry, I went the wrong way. We looked at these research questions. We wanted to look at whether there were factors in the individuals that would be associated with greater participation. And then we also wanted to see if pet ownership had anything to do with their likelihood to participate in the activity. So we thought that what would happen is that when people walked more, they would have better BMI, as we would expect. The literature predicts on physical activity. And that it would also increase their motivation to do other physical activity. And that was an interesting one, because we were seeing the animal shelter as a potential purveyor then of an improvement in public health motivation. The participants had to be 18 years of age and older, and we didn't want people out there walking with hypertension that was untreated or a problem. And so they also, of course, had to be willing, and they had to complete the 4 weeks of this program. Here's the list of the measures. We want to get a decent demographic picture of the people, some information about their health history, some of the issues that they have. We took blood pressure every week because we wanted to rule out anybody that might be at risk as well. And we measured height and weight right out there at the animal shelter. That was an interesting thing. We had a tent, and you'll see that in a minute. Then we looked at physical activity stage of change. This is an 8-item instrument where people indicate their not only their likelihood, but also their actual participation in physical activity and their attitude toward it. And they did a post-walk questionnaire which asked them to describe the experience that they had each week. And those turned out to be very interesting qualitative data. So you can see these young people are under the tent. It's a community program. It's very important that everyone feel excited to come, welcomed to come, have a high identity with the program. So these two students are wearing the T-shirts. Everybody who participated got one of our magnificent T-shirts, and they loved our magnificent T-shirts. I see them walking around the mall all over the place. These T-shirts have great longevity. We marked off the nature trail, which is a beautiful nature trail, tree-covered, from the animal shelter. It goes out quite a long distance. I don't know the total length of it, but we marked out a one-mile track, encouraging people. They'd gone a quarter mile, a half mile, three-quarters of a mile, 1 mile, wahoo! And they could at that point turn around or go further. And you can see that we didn't always have the most physically capable people participating. In the bottom picture you see on the right, it's dark, I apologize for that. A student is carrying a chair. This elderly gentleman and his wife came every single time. In fact, they didn't just come 4 sessions, they came the whole summer. And he's got his cane, and they sometimes would get weak and tired, and we'd put the chair out, and they'd sit down for a few minutes and then keep walking. But they walked a lot of miles and loved the program. So we marked out the course. There were benches available, and we did have people on the trail, such as this young man, with a cell phone in case anybody got hurt or there were any problems along the way. A little bit on our findings. We had in this group 281, as mostly female. That wasn't entirely surprising. And you can see the average age went from 18 to, or the ages went from 18 to 85. This 85-year-old lady would ride her bike to the animal shelter, get off the bike, walk one dog a mile out and back, come back and say, "Well, give me another one." Get another one, go out, walk it out a mile and back. Haven't you got any more? Get another one and take it out a mile and back, and then say, "I guess I'll go home now," and then rode her bike the 7 miles back home. Tough cookie. Yeah. So you can see that most of them lived with an animal, and here's a breakdown of the animals that they lived with, which was we thought was interesting, that people have animals at home, but they're coming to the shelter to walk someone else, other animals, unclaimed animals. And we can look at our research question results, and we used a regression on this because we did have a big enough sample. So you can see that there was no significant difference on living with a companion animal. Those who did or didn't, it was not a factor. But that factor analysis showed us that age, I want to highlight that, sorry, age accounted for 41% of the variance in participation, and then number of children. So older people were quite likely to participate, and that's a very interesting thing to me. On body mass index, as we hoped and as we expected, a number of weeks they participated demonstrated that the body mass index improved. Although if you look at these numbers, these are not astounding, but some improvement is good improvement in my opinion, and I think most of us would agree that if we could get people started on a trajectory of downward body mass index improvement, that would be beneficial. And this lady ran, walked with the dogs until the day she delivered her baby. She literally left our program and went home and had the baby. And she would take two Labradors. She went two-fisted. We said, you're the two-fisted dog walker. Physical activity stage of change was interesting. The numbers of weeks did account for a significant part of the variance in this change score. So this meant that people were moving from lesser activity levels outside of the program to approaching the value of 8, which is I do 30 minutes of moderate to vigorous activity every single day of the week. And this was very interesting. We had a lot of qualitative comments coming from participants around this who'd say, you know, I just walked that dog a mile out and a mile back. I walked 2 miles. This is ridiculous. I can do more exercise than I'm doing. I'm going to get going. Bingo. This was what we were hoping to see. So the physical activity stage of change scores were significantly higher than at baseline. Implications from that, I think, are many. We could view potentially the animal shelter as a place where a physical, public health, physical activity enhancement, exercise activity could occur. People were very, very committed to coming and helping the dogs. We walked every dog in the shelter every Saturday. And the shelter staff reported that in the afternoon when they opened for people to come and see the animals, the dogs were quieter, they were not bouncing around off the wall, and were more likely to be adopted, although we haven't tracked the adoption rates during the program. That's an anecdotal report. You know, you never want to hang your whole hat on that, but it's something that we think is worth looking into. And then it's clear that it didn't have to do with whether people had a companion animal or not. So people were actually walking their own dog, leaving it home, and then coming to the shelter to walk these animals. And there's a great deal of compassion expressed by the participants in wanting to help these poor dogs who they saw through no fault of their own were homeless in the shelter. I'd like to acknowledge a whole range of students. We have a bevy of students who work with us on everything we do, and it's very enriching and wonderful, and also our funders, Waltham, Center for Pet Nutrition Research, and the agencies who worked with us on the project. And then I would love to have any questions. And by thank you. Thank you. By way of shameless self-promotion, this is my book entitled Walk a Hound, Lose a Pound, and it's a consumer's guide to dog walking, available on Amazon, and I have 4 copies here in case anybody wants. Okay. And questions, love to have. Yes?
Did you do any follow-up to look at long-term benefits? I mean, I know that's
a standard question. Yeah, it is. What we have is, these are cross-sectional data. However, we conducted the study for 5 years, so we have data all the way along every year for 5 years. What we don't have is 5 years of data on everybody, so you know that necessarily gets into a little bit of a struggle. But I think that's a very important point. Follow-up of the people who participated is a very good thing to do, and it would be sensible for the next step. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, that's a good question. It's very interesting. We really had 4 adoptions out of all these people, and I thought there would be more, but there were only 4. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
I know you have an inclusion criteria. Did you have any inclusion criteria for, like, the gentleman who needed the chair, endurance, or balance? And the second full question to that, do you see any improvement in their balance and their endurance?
Yeah, that couple improved enormously. What was interesting about them was that when they started, we had their physician or healthcare provider assent to participate. That was required. But the first day I thought they were going to die when they walked from this chair to that chair. And we had to follow them, he and his wife, with a chair that day. And I was just sitting there thinking, I'm going to kill somebody trying to get him to walk a dog. And it was a very interesting thing that, yes, they absolutely improved because you saw then he was out on the trail. He and his wife worked up to being able to go out on the trail. At first, they could only walk, you know, just a little ways from our tent. So we definitely saw improvement in them. Yes. I like the name. If people thought they'd lose a ton, I think we'd be deluged with participants potential. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, yes, I think it's a very good idea. We haven't done it, but I think I'd like to pursue that idea. But let's just be honest, there are a lot of people that can't run. And we have conducted two other dog walking studies, one with sedentary, overweight residents of public housing, and there's no way they eat. We got them to lose 14 pounds on average in this crowd that had been doing zero and were morbidly obese. And just by walking dogs. So for them, yes, wouldn't it be good if we could get them up to a point where they could run? I think that would be great. For younger people, why not? Sure, it's a great idea. And we did demonstrate in another study significant increases in the normal walking speed of older adults who walked with a dog. So we were getting them closer to being able to be more physically active than just walking as well. Yes, sir?
What type of dog?
Why we didn't all take a lot of animals home? It was very difficult. I'm a setarian person. I have a Gordon setter. I've had setters for 35 years.
Which is a fairly big dog. I mean,
71 pounds of love and activity. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And you're not going to get as much exercise if you're running a Chihuahua as if you're going to run with me and my Gordon.
Usually I was running from the Chihuahua, so I got lots of exercise. We want to open this for all the speakers now because like Dr. Lawler didn't have much time, and Haley will be leaving here shortly, so also Dr. Goodall. So if you got any questions for any of our speakers, we definitely want to welcome all, thank all of them.
It's gone well over 3,500 dogs now, and the DOC is very vigorous in their record keeping, and they're keeping track of all of those things. There is nothing with the dog, nothing with the prisoners. There was one episode of violence against a yellow lab, and there were two offenders who had not been participating well, who were not living up to the expectations, and the other offenders in their housing unit went to the coordinator and said, if you don't take them out, we're going to take them out. And we're going to have trouble here. And so that very night, the coordinator was planning the next day to take these two guys away from the housing unit, and they One of them wanted the lab to go into the cell, and they hadn't been working with the lab, and they were not very nice to the lab, and so they threw the lab into the cell, and the other offenders training the dogs grabbed them, and by the way, these guys were not kicked out of the program for doing this violence, but they grabbed these two guys, and they held them at bay, and called for the attendant and the guard, you know, warden, a guard, and they were taken out, and they were put in solitary confinement and had time added to their sentences. It's the one episode, because there's zero tolerance, but there was that one episode. Yeah. Yeah. We don't have the results. The DOC is looking at the results in terms of the medical services used. And, you know, we identified the difficulties of the confounders in the medical services used. So what they're doing is removing all the outliers that have conditions that could have confounded the findings for the puppies for parole medical service use, and then calculating the cost.
Tom?
Training sessions with the National Certified Dog Trainer. However, there have been instances where certain offenders have been taken upon themselves to be the leader and say, hey, let's get the dogs together, you know, when Miss Judy is not here, and let's train the dog and do that. And that absolutely happened. And there was, you know, we didn't measure it, but there certainly was an increase in that communication and collaboration with the offenders. So they all have the common goal of training the dogs, doing it successfully, and getting those dogs home.
My second question would be more of the abuse side. It would have to be not just the dog, but also the feral cats, where the abuse of the family would be to release the animal, not taking it with the family, which is one of the reasons there were so many deaths in New Orleans, that the people would not leave their pets behind. But I'm just thinking the socialization where all of a sudden you leave the animal behind, and then you do have the caregiver could be getting exercise by going out 24/7 taking care of these colonies where they may not be really tested, but yet they go out no matter what, snowstorms or whatever, they're taking care of the animal. I'm just wondering about that socialization, which possibly could go back to you, Doc, to how many generations, you know, the animals themselves have been abused before, returning back to packs.
Yeah, that's a real good question. One of the best examples I can think of is the dingo, which is also Canis lupus dingo. It's also the canid family, Canis genus. The dingo developed from the domestic dog, the archaeological data suggests about 3,500 years ago. The genetic data suggests it may be somewhat longer than that. And the dog was already domesticated by that time, although the dingo is marginal today. And the people, I haven't been around a lot of dingoes, but people that have been around them a lot say that, you know, some of them are okay and some of them aren't. So that's kind of a case of you know, the two-directional does seem to be possible. In the ancient specimens, you see a lot of things that clearly were accidental, but you have to be careful how you interpret it because they were living in rough neighborhoods and it was a hard life. I don't see much that I would say is consistent with abuse. You know, the primary pathology, as I said, is oral cavity and evidence of dental disease. And then the second most common thing is mild to moderate osteoarthritis, which is most consistent, which is the very active lifestyle. You see fractures, but not that often, and you see more fractures like the dog from Iowa that I pointed out. That's a Great Plains dog and a large dog, and those dogs were larger because they were helping the people chase down elk and bison, because that was prior to the time where there were any equines in North America. So, yeah.
Another question for you.
For me.
Yeah, most of those 10,000 up to 10,000 BC, you had North American slides up there. How did those compare with the same time period in Europe?
I've worked with a group, Dr. Richard Thomas, at one of the UK veterinary schools, and we tend to see substantially the same thing. Yeah, and again, back then, I don't think humans had a lot of time to commit abusive acts, but we also have to remember that we don't see soft tissues, we only see the bones. But in general, what we do have available to us, we do tend to see the same things.
My question is for Dr. Johnson. It's a subject in the Washington Mountain program. Was they trained before they were allowed to handle the dogs and walk them?
That's a wonderful question. Yes, it's. And I didn't show the overall logic model for the project. But yes, the first thing that we did was to have everybody learn how to do leash handling, how to, you know, where to put the leash over, and yes, we did that.
Yeah, I work at a shelter, so I see a lot of volunteers coming in with varying, you know, knowledge of how to walk a dog. So.
Right. Yeah, it's very, very important point, and we did. And then we also had everybody do some preliminary stretching activities to warm up before we gave them the animal for the day. Thanks.
Ornery guy in the back, Jim Dale.
The head mark had said we'd like to invite everybody here that doesn't have a second section. If you'd like to join the Veterinary Public Health Group, we'd love to have you. Your input for wonderful sessions like this, thank you, Dr. Shaw.
Thank you, Jim.
Are meaningful to us, and be able to, if we have more membership, we'll be able to stay a critical mass and continue to be a functioning unit of APHA. So here we have a wonderful group here. We'd like to invite you to join us as a second section. It would be great. You know, it's only, I don't know if it's anything you belong to. So if you look at your badge here and you only have one on there, just join us, BPH, and we'd love to have you.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate that.
So when you join APHA, it'll say, go down towards the bottom and say, you want a second section? You go, yes. And then you look for the BPH Special Interest Group. And if you can't find it, email Tom. Tom Yoder.
There's not many dokers to email, so.
Or being an instructor. I'm Jim Dale.
Any other questions for this great group of speakers we had? No? Well, let's give them a round of applause. Thank you very much.